You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 28th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to the Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24 with me, Paul Osborne. Coming up in the programme, crisis meetings in the middle of the night in Tokyo and Seoul as North Korea stages another missile test. We'll get the latest in just a moment. Plus,
one of the big problems here that I'm discovering in the comms team is that senior people are really the guys doing the leaking and they ask junior people to leak for them.
The arrival of Anthony Scaramucci in Washington causes a stir. We'll ask if it's connected to the exit of White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus. And in light of the new Director of Communications' frenzy of foul language, we'll also look at the history of political swearing. Later, the risk of water rationing as a drought takes hold in Rome, and we'll wrap up a week spent discussing how to build a resilient city in New York. All in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. First, a quick look at some of the day's other top stories. And first, a story that's broken in the last few minutes. The President, Donald Trump, has sacked his White House Chief of Staff. Reince Priebus has left. He announced this on Twitter around 10 minutes ago. He is being replaced by the Homeland Security Secretary, General John Kelly. It comes 2 days after Mr. Trump's new Director of Communications, Anthony Scaramucci, attacked Reince Priebus, accusing him of leaking damaging information. A man's been killed and six other people have been injured in a knife attack at a supermarket in Germany. The suspect, who's thought to be from the United Arab Emirates, was overpowered by passers-by in Hamburg. Police there have said it's too soon to identify a motive. Russia has retaliated to new US sanctions by telling America to cut its diplomatic staff and barring the use of some properties. It's a response to the seizure by the US last year of two Russian diplomatic compounds. Russia's now demanded their return, accusing the US of, in its words, stubbornly taking one anti-Russian step after another. India's Supreme Court has refused to allow an abortion for a 10-year-old girl who was allegedly raped by her own uncle. The court said that her pregnancy was too advanced. The victim is said to be just 2 months away from giving birth, but her pregnancy was only discovered 2 weeks ago. And officials in the US are trying to limit the nicotine content of tobacco products for the first time. The Food and Drug Administration's announcement triggered sharp falls in the values of major tobacco firms. The FDA says tobacco is responsible for nearly 500,000 American deaths every year and costs $300 billion in medical bills. Welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily. First, 3 weeks ago, North Korea staged its first test of an intercontinental ballistic missile. Today, it staged its second, this time testing a missile reportedly capable of hitting U.S. cities, including Denver and Chicago. The missile landed in the sea off Japan, sparking emergency dead-of-night meetings in both Seoul and Tokyo. This is the 14th North Korean missile test this year. It's quite possibly the most alarming as well. On the line to discuss it is Aidan Foster Carter, honorary senior research fellow in sociology and modern Korea at Leeds University here in the UK. Aidan, thank you for your time this evening. First of all, what do we know about this latest missile test?
Not a great deal so far as I'm aware. What is new, for one thing, is the timing. These things are coming thick and fast, as we know, every few weeks, especially this year. But they normally come shortly after dawn, local Korean time. This one came in the middle of the night, inconveniently, no doubt, for people in the area. As you said, sort of emergency meetings hastily called at in the small hours, local time. The other thing is it does seem to be an ICBM. We know that they have a pattern of lofting with these things. They don't want to actually fire them the full, who knows, perhaps up to 8 to 10,000 kilometers this might be able to go. So putting this very non-technically, being non-technical myself, you fire it very high into the air, almost 2,000 miles, and down it comes in the Sea of Japan, or East Sea, as all Koreans call it, possibly in Japanese economic zone. And so it's yet again, Kim Jong-un is showing the world that he is very good at this. seems but a year ago that every other North Korean nuclear missile, missile test, and they weren't ICBMs then, used to fail, and we were sort of quite reassured, perhaps complacent. So we will doubt this no more once analysts have been able to sort of get more readings and so forth, but it forms part of the pattern and it just gets more and more worrying.
Well, you mentioned there that this one fell into the sea of Japan. The Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said there is, in his words, a grave and real threat to his country's security. Does that mean, though, that North Korea's neighbours are going to be any more willing to take some sort of concerted united action?
No, because they continue to disagree as countries further afield, which aren't so much in the firing line, also disagree about what to do. In fact, Japan and South Korea, which are at the front line, basically are a case in point. Shinzo Abe is a hardline conservative who has actually his own agenda. Not to be misunderstood, but perhaps North Korea is not inconvenient for it. I'm not denying the North Korean threat, but, you know, very hardline in North Korea. But South Korea has had a change of government. The previous president, now behind bars and on trial, Park Geun-hye, very much agreed with Shinzo Abe. But now we have Moon Jae-in, who would like to revive the sunshine policy, would like to talk to North Korea, believes there has to be a diplomatic track as well as sanctions. He's not having much luck with that so far, because North Korea won't talk to him any more than it seems happy to talk to anybody else. But that gives an example. You know, something must be done, we can all agree, but at that point there is a bifurcation. I don't know that anybody actually wants to go down the military road, though, more and more, which is just almost too horrendous to contemplate, but one has to think about it, I suppose. But there are urgent voices, actually, in many countries, suggesting that there needs to be diplomacy. But Kim Jong-un isn't exactly sort of helping, you might say, by only doing if he keeps firing the missiles and not really giving any clear indication of what kind of diplomacy might be possible. So it gets worse.
Now, you mentioned at the top of the program that the US seems to be going through a great deal of political turmoil at the moment, with Donald Trump making all sorts of announcements. But the Pentagon did have time to put out some response to the North Korean missile test, said that the US was prepared to defend its allies. The initial analysis of this latest missile has suggested it could probably reach the Western United States and possibly even as far as Chicago. That's going to concentrate minds, isn't it?
It certainly is, and of course that's the key thing is, are we talking about defending allies or not? I mean, if there's a timing on this one, and there usually is with the North Koreans, we've just had the anniversary of the armistice that ended the Korean War 64 years ago, the last time the peninsula did get hot. It is, of course, just an armistice and not a peace treaty. Defending the allies, I mean, the deterrence on the spot has worked brilliantly, actually, for two-thirds of a century almost. South Korea, from that war-ravaged place, poorer than the North for a while, has recovered to be the global economic power, you know, where Samsung and Hyundai, etc., come from, that we know today, and indeed, nowadays, a well-functioning democracy also. So that, you know, defending the peninsula, defending allies, Japan for that matter, has been done extremely well. Deterrence has worked. And it is rather important. I think there was concern about this earlier in the year with some of the things that Trump was tweeting. I think maybe President shouldn't tweet, but maybe we'll not get into that. You know, if one just meets bluster with bluster and menace with menace, it's bad enough for the North Koreans to be doing it. But, you know, there is a real worry, particularly in South Korea. I'm not quite sure about the Japanese people, but perhaps the same, that, you know, the ally that is there to defend you, that's the whole basis of the thing, might, because it itself feels under threat, or might be tempted to do something unilateral. And then one thing is for certain, we can debate how far into America this thing might or not be able to go. We know for certain that they could rain fire on Seoul, not with any missiles, but just with the several thousand artillery tubes just north of the humorously named demilitarized zone.
The issue that many people who analyze North Korea's missile program say is holding them back is that they might have missiles that are capable of reaching the US. What they haven't been able to do yet is miniaturize nuclear warheads and be confident of attaching them to those missiles and delivering them to their targets. But some people have said they might only be 5 years away from that.
I say, I'm not on the technical side. I'd heard less than that. I mean, it's certainly one thing position that I guess nobody can afford to be in is where we always think, oh, we're not there yet, they're not there yet. It's as if, you know, we're kicking a can down the road, or we need to change the metaphor, where actually the North Koreans are steadily kicking their can down the road, and we can argue about how far away it is. I mean, there is definitely a threat. Again, though, I mean, in the whole sort of slightly MAD, but Focused World of Deterrence, the fact that they have capacity, you have capacity X, doesn't mean that you are about to. As soon as, you know, one fine day, the North Korean scientists will tell Kim Jong-un, we can hit New York, and he'll say, well, go, boy, go. I mean, the regime survival is very much on his mind. It's very important to try and ascertain motives. A great deal of it is their own fear for their own security, having seen the fate of Iraq, having seen the fate of Gaddafi in Libya and so forth. But, of course, the way they go about it makes their own position more precarious, too. I do think, you know, some form of concentrating minds into diplomacy is going to have to come within the next few months. I would actually expect that.
Aidan, thank you very much. That's Aidan Foster-Carter from Leeds University here in the UK. You're listening to Monocle 24. And you're with the Monocle Daily. Now we're off to the United States. At this point, we were going to have a conversation about the consequences of profanity in politics, and we will get to that in a few minutes. But that profanity that we were going to discuss has had a direct consequence in the last few minutes, because Donald Trump has been busy tweeting again, and he's announced that the White House Chief of Staff, Reince Priebus, is being replaced. Let's get the latest now from Monocle's Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg. Replaced or voluntarily stepping down or sacked?
CNN is just reporting in the last few minutes that Priebus resigned yesterday. But, this has been a long time coming, that the extent to which, you know, it has been made clear to Priebus that he's not particularly beloved by the boss and doesn't have much of a home in this administration. That's been clear, you know, probably all the way back to February. And so there had been talk at the beginning that the Priebus was expecting maybe he would stay for a year. There was talk about him easing himself out by getting the ambassadorship to Greece. He's of Greek descent. I think last night's seeming demise of the health care bill on the floor of the Senate may have had something to do with the timing. Priebus was the biggest advocate internally for pushing ahead on repeal of Obamacare in these first few months of the administration, which has turned into a quagmire. He suggested be fairly easy, has a very good relationship with House Speaker Paul Ryan. They both come out of Wisconsin Republican politics. And so I think the failure of that legislative campaign kind of ended any big project he had left. And the infighting there is probably too brutal to make it worth staying, even if the president would let him hang on.
Sean Spicer was an ally of Reince Priebus. He's gone. Priebus is gone. Anthony Scaramucci seems to be the man with all the power at the moment. Is this a Trump team relaunch, or is the White House just too chaotic for anything like that?
Yeah, I think it's too chaotic. You know, part of the difficulty of thinking about a relaunch is that the job responsibilities and chain of command were never terribly clear in the first place. And so reassigning duties would be very hard to execute here. Traditionally, the chief of staff is such an important job because it's effectively the chief operating officer of the White House. If we think of the president as the CEO, it is the chief of staff who is the central point of contact, the gatekeeper to the CEO, and the person who is the boss of everybody else who works there. And Trump has had, quite literally an open door policy where everybody, including junior staffers, can kind of get his attention, which is usually treated as the most scarce resource in a White House, the president's time. And also where the chain of command isn't clear, where there are all these different power centers, Steve Bannon's, what was Sean Spicer's in the communications office, Jared Kushner's empire alongside his wife, Ivanka, some outside advisors who have input, Mike Pence, who's incredibly powerful, and each of them have their own sort of access to the president. So Priebus was very weak to begin with. So what we saw this week with Scaramucci coming in was not just that he was a center of attention, but that very plainly it was announced that he would report directly to the president, which is not what a communications director usually does. So part of the question is, will John Kelly, who comes out of a military background where you have clearly defined lines of command, will he be able to make of this a more traditional chief of staff role? And that would require the president having a kind of willingness to adjust the sort of improvisational style that he's brought to decision-making in his first 6 months.
Well, you mentioned Anthony Scaramucci there. It's only 24 hours ago that he went on television to call Reince Priebus, to challenge Reince Priebus to deny leaking. It's only a day or so ago that the New Yorker posted an interview in which he described Mr. Priebus as a paranoid schizophrenic who will be asked to resign very shortly.
Yeah, and I think that this is, you know, that is symptom of the same disease that made Priebus sort of uncomfortable in the White House for a while now, more than it was probably a catalyst. You know, there has been, it's been pretty clear to journalists covering this White House, and I think it's become clearer to the president and the family members who advise him closely, that there was a lot of self-interest in the sort of Priebus-Spicer world in the White House, that they jumped to attention whenever there were stories that looked bad for Reince Priebus, the allegation that they were pushing sort of palace intrigue stories that reflected poorly on, at various points, Steve Bannon, Jared Kushner, and others, and that everybody was sort of out for him or herself. And so Scaramucci's talk of conducting a hunt for leakers in the White House really focused on the idea that there was this cabal, this, you know, Spicer Priebus world that was foremost concerned with protecting their reputations rather than the president's.
Sasha, thank you very much. That's Monocle's Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg, there on that breaking news of the resignation of White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, announced in the last half hour or so. And in just a moment, we'll be talking a little more about that man who seems to be very much on the up in Washington, Anthony Scaramucci. Do stay with us. Well, you can understand why Donald Trump is such a fan of Mr. Scaramucci. His new White House communications director, who it seems has succeeded in pushing out his mortal enemy, Reince Priebus, this evening, has only been in the job for a week. He'd already forced out the press secretary, Sean Spicer. He's triggered other resignations before tonight. And 24 hours ago, he launched into a distinctly foul-mouthed outburst on the phone to a journalist, who promptly, as any journalist would, reported every single potty-mouthed word to fall from the lips of the man who calls himself the Mooch. It's fair to say he doesn't hide his anger terribly well, or do it in especially polite terms, but Scaramucci is far from the first person at the top of politics to have an attachment to, well, let's call it earthy language. On the line now is Melissa Moore, who's the author of the book Holy Shit, The History of Swearing. Melissa, leaving aside the fact that Mr. Scaramucci in that yelling, screeching phone call with a journalist didn't appear to understand what a felony was, or that journalists don't normally just hand over the names of their sources. Let's just focus on the language, because for a man who's very new to his job, he didn't waste much time insulting people who've been there a lot longer.
No, he didn't. No, that was kind of an incredible amount of profanity. But I think, as you just mentioned, that's, I'm sure, one of the reasons Trump really likes him, because his language, although the actual terms he used are a little bit different from the way Trump usually swears. I mean, they both are, you know, masters at that sort of rhetoric.
What do you make of his swearing abilities? He seems to have a relatively small swearing vocabulary that he relies on over and over again.
Well, it is. I was just thinking about both his and Trump's sort of techniques. And it is very interesting, because although they use some very offensive words, like Scaramucci was in his talking to the reporter saying, you know, that Steve Bannon, who's another Trump advisor, you know, that he is trying to suck his own cock, and that various people are cock blocking. And I mean, it's really crude. But he doesn't actually use any racial slurs or epithets that would really, really offend people in the United States. And they don't, neither he nor Trump, at least publicly that we know, uses the C word, uses the word cunt. And so while their language is really offensive, I mean genuinely offensive to many people, it's not at the highest level of offense. And I'm wondering if they will ever go there, and what would happen if they did.
Well, I wonder if people are a little bit hypocritical sometimes about swearing, because I don't think you could name a senior politician or advisor who doesn't swear like a trooper in private. The sin seems to be doing it in public. I mean, this wasn't even in public. This was on the phone to a reporter. So his sin was imagining that it wouldn't be reported by a reporter.
Somehow. Yes.
But we affect to be sort of outraged and offended by swearing. He's not in church. He's in a high-profile, high-pressure workplace, and he's using language that, frankly, most of us do.
Yes, yes. No, I think that is definitely true. And I think that in the United States at this point, it's almost a relief to be able to get offended by the swearing, because although you say it, you know, people might say it, it violates propriety and, you know, delicate ears of children or whatever, this actually doesn't hurt anybody. And there's so much going on in the Trump administration right now that actually has real consequences for millions and billions of people that, you know, talking about what's going on with the swearing is kind of comic relief almost.
You mentioned a little while ago that while he used a lot of, I'm trying to be terribly English about this.
Sorry.
While he used a lot of words that are, shall we say, sexual in origin, what he didn't do was use any sort of racial epithets. And I suppose those words that we consider to be very offensive, vulgar language or something, they aren't really causing that much offense to people, but it racial insults, racial epithets, they're the real taboos, aren't they? And they would be the things that would get somebody sacked.
Yeah, I think that might actually really offend. I mean, I think, yes, there are degrees of being offended, and people are obviously, you know, upset about some of the language that's coming out of Scaramucci in particular. But yes, I think if they did use racial terms or even insulting women, like, I think people were maybe more upset when Trump said, sorry, I'm going to be very blunt and American, when Trump, before he was elected, said, you know, with women, you just grab them by the pussy, you know, that, which is less of a bad word than, you know, cock block. I think that's people got more offended about that because that demonstrates something about his attitude towards women in a way that Scaramucci ranting kind of does, you know, doesn't.
Having said that, it didn't stop him winning the presidency.
No, it didn't. No, exactly. No, I think people, I think one of the, it's kind of interesting in the U.S. to watch Democrats now experiment with swearing, because they're clearly Trump, the way Trump talks, swearing seems very natural, but that's partly because he doesn't really give set speeches. Whatever he says is very improvisational, and so it seems very natural for him to swear. And so some Democrats a couple months ago started trying out, saying, oh, well, you know, is Trump keeping his promises? Fuck no. But I think it didn't work as well for them, because they're still abiding by those norms of discourse that say politics is a serious thing. We write speeches, we give reasoned accounts of what we're doing, and swearing doesn't fit as well in there. But if you just kind of get up and talk about whatever you want, swearing seems very natural and makes people think that what you're saying is coming from your heart.
Well, given how many of Mr. Scaramucci's enemies have been pushed out of the White House in just 1 week, it would seem it's about to become a much swearier place. Melissa Moore, thank you very much for joining us. Melissa is the author of the book Holy Shit, The History of Swearing.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in. And it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
And this is the Monocle Daily from Monocle 24. Now, Italy's environment minister says the country is doing all it can to avoid rationing water during a drought. Rome is worst affected. Below average rainfall and failing infrastructure too have combined to create a situation which officials have warned could escalate quickly. The Vatican's already switched off its fountains, but hundreds of thousands of people in Italy's capital could be at risk of water rationing. Well, on the line now is Monocle's Rome correspondent, David Pleasant. David, Rome had 26 rainy days in the first half of this year, 88 in the first half of 2016. Clearly, that's not good. But major cities are meant to be prepared for things like this.
Well, exactly, Paul. And I think that the excuses are sort of running thin for the city authorities. Mayor Virginia Raggi constantly embattled a mayor who came on a radical civic platform. It has a lot to answer for again. Although the latest news on this is the rationing has actually been postponed. So Rome doesn't face imminent rationing. It was said to be on Monday was when the rationing was set to start. And that seems to be thanks to Virginia Raggi's pleas to the government for this to not go through. She mentioned economic reasons and social reasons, and also Italy's image abroad was cited by the mayor herself. So in one instance, she might have just about got away with it for now. But as you mentioned, the meteorological situation is very dry, and there is no rain forecast. So it's a pretty dire situation for Romans at the moment.
It is extraordinary that leaking aqueducts mean that 40% of the water supply is lost before it reaches the people who are meant to get it.
Exactly, and the mayor's office is again on this reason being criticised, and the opponents of the five-star movement are lining up with yet more evidence that they're not doing their job in the mayor's office. 40%, as you mentioned. Recently, 1 month ago, the famous drinking fountains, the big nose, the so-called big nose fountains because of their spout, it was proclaimed that they would be turned off. But they only use about 1% of the waste of the water, compared to 40% that just leaks through these aqueducts. A lot of them, there's a misconception that Rome uses the ancient Roman aqueducts. That's not entirely true, but a lot of them are up to 90 years old, so not exactly brand new, gleaming infrastructure there. And there's been an underinvestment in Acea, the local main water utility company, and this is the main problem. And even today, the managers of Acea are saying that investment has to be stepped up as of now. You know, the situation is urgent, so there is a lot to answer for. And I think hopefully this drastic situation will lead to that.
Is this something that will be left to Rome's city authorities, or is this a situation where the Italian government nationally has to step in?
Well, part of the mayor Raggi's pleas were for government intervention. Surprisingly, Rome or the province of Rome or the metropolitan area or the Lazio region were not in the list of areas that were declared in a state of emergency, unlike Parma and Piacenza up in the north, that are very agricultural and rich provinces. So perhaps they got their act together quicker and got that declaration of a state of emergency. Rome is currently on the waiting list for that to be declared. So I think after this debacle that has hit the national news, I think Rome will be next to be declared in a state of emergency. And that frees up some millions of euros in terms of buying drinking water tanks and investing in infrastructure in the short term, but hopefully we'll garner enough attention for vital infrastructure work to be carried out.
You mentioned that Rome hasn't actually been put into that status yet, but across the country, farmers say the drought's done 2 billion euros of damage to the agriculture industry.
That's correct, and it's the type of industry that Italy's famous for. So we're talking about tomatoes in Puglia, and grapes in all the vineyards. These were very, very thirsty thirsty forms of agriculture, and they're the ones that are being most affected. We probably won't see the true damage until harvest, where the farmers are saying that there's likely to be diminished harvests and bad quality, lower quality in terms of what is cultivated. So it's really a very damaging situation, and I don't think we've really seen the end of it. We're only midway through the winter. We're not even into August yet, and as I say, there is no rain forecast by the meteorological or the aeronautical institute that looks after the weather forecast. There's no rain forecast for up to 3 weeks. So it seems to be improving for the time being, Paul.
Now, just lastly, you mentioned there that the mayor of Rome was worried about the reputational damage that this could do around the world to the city. Even if water rationing is avoided, this still sends a pretty poor signal about the state of Italy's capital.
Absolutely. It's just yet another yet more bad press for Rome. And it just seems to be a spiral of kind of negative messages. It seems to be, the mayor seems to be water hosing any criticisms. And there's no real implementation of any kind of strategic plan for Rome. And I think that's the problem. There doesn't seem to be a vision or message or identity for the city. And I think this is a sort of systemic problem that's been perhaps the case for centuries. But as cities sort of have a global agenda, and cities like Madrid or Lisbon or other even smaller cities in Europe and beyond really have a message for themselves to attract business and visitors, Rome just doesn't seem to have that, and just sort of relies on this mass tourism that in itself is causing problems, and doesn't seem to be stepping beyond that. And the kind of calamitous state of the city government really doesn't help that. So there's really kind of a feeling of inertia in Rome, and I don't know how much longer the residents were going to put up with it.
David, thank you very much. That's Monocle's correspondent in Rome, David Pleasant. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24.
Buckle up, put the armrest down, and slide away that table. The third edition of The Escapist, Monocle's annual travel-focused journal, has landed. Our editors and bureau chiefs offer you their take on those far-flung places where opportunity and great design find a home. We head to Semmering in Austria, a sleeping architectural beauty being gently awoken by an ambitious set of hospitality entrepreneurs. Then we take a drive down Turkey's liberal west coast and dust up on Broome's long history of welcoming new arrivals to Western Australia. Also, our culture editor, Rob Bound, sifts the treasure from the trash in Benidorm. We also reveal the winner of Monocle's third annual restaurant awards, as well as a crop of comfy new hotels in which to rest your head. The Escapist is your summer set piece, packed with the sunniest and smartest insights from leaders in the travel industry. The Escapist, on newsstands now.
Well, what with all of this stuff coming out of Washington, it's been a night of surprises. I have another surprise for you now. Did you know that our perception of what a dinosaur looks like is actually something surprisingly recent? Considering we'll never be absolutely certain about the skin tone of a triceratops or the precise makeup of the scales of a T-Rex, some of the ideas that we've seen in the past have been rather creative. The genre is known as paleo art. And it's been collected in a new book called Visions of the Prehistoric Past. Its authors are Zoe Lescaz and Walton Ford. And a little earlier, Zoe joined Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco to tell him more.
Dinosaurs, they're everywhere, but it's hard to remember sometimes that this is a fairly recent genre. Prior to 1830, there were no pictures of prehistoric animals, and it was only then that people started to imagine what these reptiles and other creatures may have looked like and what their world may have looked like. It started then because that was around the time that scientists in London and continental Europe were first discovering prehistoric reptiles and identifying them as such. I mean, people have been finding dinosaur bones for hundreds of years or millennia, and they had previously thought these might be the bones of dragons or of giants. And it was in 1796 that the French anatomist Georges Cuvier took one look at some mammoth bones, and he was a brilliant scientist who you could hand him the wing of a fruit bat and he could tell you exactly which species it was. And so he looked at the bones of some mammoths from Siberia and realized that these were not elephants as many people thought they were because they look so similar. He realized, no, these are a species that no longer exists. They're so big. If they existed, we'd see them around. And so that's when extinction started to catch on. It was a real process, though. And that's another important thing to remember and to grapple with as we look at these images. We're so used now to thinking of global warming and species extinction and climate change that it's hard to remember that people living in the 19th century thought every animal that was on Earth had been created on the same day and would be around forever, and that humans would be around forever. So the concept of extinction itself was extremely threatening. And I think the threat and the fear and the uncertainty posed by that concept makes its way into the earliest works of paleoart. So you'll see some images at the beginning of the book where there are these really monstrous animals fighting tooth and claw and mauling each other underwater. Everyone is bleeding. Everyone is biting one another. Everyone's chasing one another. And it's a real frenzy. And that was sort of one aspect of the beginning of paleoart. And there are other images that are more Edenic and peaceful. The genre is interesting to me because it is so various. There's just so many artistic visions contained within it.
I think some of them, like noticing in the book, I mean, there are a lot of kind of dinosaurs fighting in a way, which of course makes it for a good image. But I mean, of course, they want to try to make it as real as possible, but they were creating certain situations that perhaps wouldn't be real. So it's kind of they were being quite playful as well, don't you think?
Yes, definitely. Whether intentionally or not, a paleoart is a vehicle for artists and whole society's fears and fantasies. I think that because no one has ever seen a prehistoric animal, fossils become blank slates upon which we can project some of our wildest, most imaginative ideas. And many of the artists working in this genre, if not all of them, were working very seriously with sober scientific intentions. They were looking very carefully at the fossil evidence and trying to reconstruct the creature and trying to reconstruct the creature's environment. But nonetheless, these fantastical elements made their way in there anyway. And a great example of that is the violence you see in some of these images. I mean, there are volcanoes going off in the background. There are bolts of lightning streaking through these tumultuous cloudy skies. It's incredibly dramatic and theatrical. And I think that that's one of the sort of interesting parts of paleoart, that while it's created in a scientific realm, it's also created to entertain in a way. I mean, you rarely see a work of paleoart where the dinosaur's back is turned or where it's hidden behind some leaves or sleeping or dead or, you know, just sort of sitting around. I mean, these are scientific images that have a lot of subjective narrative, a lot of whimsy and fantasy in them as well.
And Zoe, is paleoart something that is still kind of going strong these days?
It changed immensely, even in the first decades after the genre took off in 1830. Every artist brought different ideas to the table. And again, that's what makes the genre so interesting to me. You have not only these different visions of prehistory as either nightmarish or peaceful, but you also have different artistic styles. If someone was influenced by, say, French Impressionism, as this one American artist, Charles Knight, was, he might paint prehistory in the style of the French Impressionists. So if Claude Monet is painting haystacks with golden light and purple shadows, you then see velociraptors with purple shadows and golden light, and while other artists are bringing their own sensibilities to it. So paleoart really changed from artist to artist to artist all throughout the years. It continues on today. The book I wrote cuts off more or less around 1990, and that's because as an art historian, I'm sort of most interested in the earlier years of the genre when there was the most room for the artist's imagination, when there was less scientific evidence available, and when there was less technology at the disposal of artists and scientists to reconstruct these animals. It's still an enormously creative process creating works of paleo art. I mean, still, we don't know so many things about how these creatures looked. And while we're slowly finding bits of fossil evidence that indicate what color a certain animal might have been, little bits of preserved pigment, or learning that many species had feathers, we still have so many more technologies now. You know, you have DNA analysis and computer modeling and stress tests that show you that, oh, if there's these sort of wear patterns on a thigh bone, then the animal must have stood like this, it must have ran like that, and then the artist has that much more information. But when the first artists were making these images, there was no existing idea, no set sort of precedent that they could model their images afterwards. And that to me is really an interesting moment, this process of invention.
Well, that's Zoe Lescar speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. It is a part of the new edition of the Monocle Weekly. You can hear that chat in full, plus interviews with the choreographer Chajal Haddell and Fergus Linehan, who's the director of the Edinburgh Festival, all on the Monocle Weekly Sunday at midday London time here on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Being a pop star seems like a dazzling, lavish lifestyle, right? But have you ever wondered how your favourite pop song was written?
I do a lot of writing in the bath with my housemates sat on the toilet taking a photo.
Or who that song was really intended for.
Writing love songs in Spanish, I could say really pathetic, sad things, and it would be a secret from the audience and also from the person that I was writing about.
Join us on The Sessions at Midori House each week, where we bring in a wealth of musical talent to perform live for us and reveal a few truths about making music and keeping your ego under control. Well, sometimes.
I'm unconsciously comparing myself like a jackass to Paul McCartney.
From electropop to indie rock and with plenty of soul to boot, tune into The Sessions at Midori House every Saturday at 8:15 London time for lessons in stardom and a soundtrack to kickstart your weekend.
Well, it's time now to take a look at some of the biggest stories across Asia. My guest tonight in the studio is Somnath Bhattabhai, who's a lecturer in media and development and international journalism at SOAS here in London. We're going to start this evening with the resignation of Nawaz Sharif, the Pakistani Prime Minister. He quit after this investigation. People will probably have forgotten the Panama Papers from 2 years ago, but that was the beginning of the downfall that has now been completed.
Yes. I mean, it's an interesting one because the investigation in this particular matter lasted only 3 months. And the Panama Papers, the cases go back to the 1980s. So you realize a very vast amount of work was done a bit too quickly. Let me unpack what has actually happened. And while there's so much conversation regarding that, you know, democracy is well and alive in Pakistan, the judiciary is functioning, it's very worrying that no prime minister in the last 70 years has managed to finish 5 years. Sharif had gone in an army coup the last time he was prime minister. The last prime minister had to leave in 2012. Either the governor general, the judiciary, or the army has always stepped in before a prime minister could complete 5 years of tenure. This, I'm not batting for Sharif. You know, corruption charges aside, it's a worrying one. Second, let's look at what exactly are the clauses under which Sharif has been removed. In the legislature, there are two clauses in 67 and 69, which says you have to be an honest person. Now, the definition of honesty is slightly tenuous here. This particular clauses have been used by the generals, the army, to keep different members of parliament in check. So for the first time, it has been used in this particular fashion. So it's a very interesting one. And also, Sharif has always had a very troublesome relationship with the army. The pressure on the judiciary was immense. So the West will be worried. India will be very worried, because at this point of time, the last year, in fact, Pakistan's deficit was immensely high. The borrowing was record across the was the highest last year. And most of the borrowing was done through China and infrastructure projects. So suddenly you'll find that Pakistan and China will become even closer, which is worrying to the US and as much to India. So a lot of things to think through in this resignation. It's not a very clear, simple judiciary has acted and Sharif has resigned. Lot of things to unpack.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned there Pakistan and China and the possible closeness of relationship, because the last few times we've talked through some of the stories out of India, it's been this developing standoff between India and China that's been dominating a lot of headlines. Now, India's defense minister has been dismissing claims about the military not being properly equipped, which seem to have been related in some way to the concerns about facing off with the Chinese.
Yeah, it's a very important development which has happened in the last week or so. The CAG report, which is the Comptroller and Auditor General report of India, which is the largest auditing body in the country, it's an independent body. It has talked about huge financial mismanagement in the procuring of weapons. Now, generally, the army used to be seen as the only clean body in India, generally incorruptible. But one has to remember that most of the corruption cases in India has been of army procurement. The first big one in the 1980s was Bofors. And since then, major arms deals which have gone wrong, in Adnan Khashoggi, the great big arms dealer accused in the Bofors, never caught, recently passed away. So, problems with India army and weaponry has been a long-standing one. Billions of dollars have been misappropriated, paid in bribes. Most recently, and by most recently, the last big war which India fought was the Kargil War in 2000. The army came back with reports of weapons not being employed, not being deployed properly, weapons which were not fit for purpose. So there was again a major upheaval, and government committees were set up, but again, nothing happened. So the CAG report is a huge wake-up call. And especially in relationship to China, the way the government is now wanting to react is to calm the situation. The National Security Advisor has gone to the BRICS meeting and has spoken to his Chinese counterpart and trying to, the rhetoric from India as far as it goes is of calmness, while China has been building up the rhetoric, realizing that India has taken a back step.
Now, in the last hour, we've talked about North Korean missile test, the possibility that it could have a long-range nuclear missile within 5 years, the continuing turmoil in the White House, and a drought in Rome. So I fear that and it's nearly the weekend, so I want us to have something more cheerful to take us into the weekend. And while illegal immigration is a global concern, we have one example about immigration unapproved and undocumented from Bangladesh, which is very much welcomed.
Yes, indeed. The elephants and the corridors which are now being opened up. One of the things which has recently has been agreed by both countries, Bangladesh and India, is that wild animals, especially elephants, because it's called the Golden Corridor, the corridor between Nepal, Bangladesh and West Bengal in India, because of a lot of drug smuggling and a lot of arms smuggling. The other thing which happens is cow smuggling and movement of elephants. Now, elephants have had a very checkered history there. Their lives have become extremely difficult in the last 150 years because of tea plantation. Tea plantations in Darjeeling, tea plantations in Assam, and tea plantations now in Bangladesh, which have started. So the corridors which were unfettered movement for the elephants have been, jungles have started to vanish. Jungles of North Bengal have started to vanish. Now slowly, I think, through conservation efforts, through efforts of the wildlife ministries of both countries, conversations have started that at least some kind of movement must be so that the elephants can cross through unfettered. Now, so many checkpoints have been put up, so much human movement is now there that elephants find it very difficult. And what happens is villages get attacked. You know, villages in the borders where the elephants used to move now get attacked very randomly and very viciously. Elephant herds come in and destroy livestock and human lives.
Well, obviously, elephants destroying human lives is not necessarily the cheery end that we were looking for. But at least the
I'll tell you. Let me end it on a slightly cheery note. See, the villages in both sides of Bengal create this thing called particular intoxicant, which these animals are addicted to. So whenever they brew it, it's a call to the wild animals to come, the elephants to come down.
So that's what they're doing. They're pursuing a drink, basically.
Yeah.
Well, you can't blame them for that. Somnath, thank you very much. Somnath Battabile from SOAS here in London. You're listening to Monocle 24. Well, next on the Monocle Daily, we're heading to New York, where the Urban Resilience Summit is coming to an end. It is a gathering of city planners, activists, and more. And Monocle's Carlotta Arabella has been across it through the week. I'm going to start with a stupid question, if I may, or what may be a stupid question at least. What do we mean by resilience? I was thinking we heard earlier about the drought in Rome and the failing infrastructure in the city that's made that crisis worse. And it's that kind of thing, floods, earthquakes, that is probably what most people think about when they consider the idea of a resilient city.
This conference has been really good at, you know, making that clear. You know, people think of resilience as immediate response to a crisis. And especially here in the U.S., you know, with the superstorms and floods, that tends to be the discourse coming out of some of the cities here in the United States. But the truth is, when we talk about resilience, it also includes, you know, social justice, racial equity, financial stability. And what has been clear is how, yes, you as a city can identify that your biggest concern has to do with climate, because that's what puts you at risk. But the only way you can become truly resilient is if you tackle all of these fronts at once. And obviously the one that concerns you the most a bit harder, but you need to consider all of this and what of all this means. Like that, I spoke, for example, with a few of the chief resilience officers, CROs, are they, as they are known, after 5 weeks. That, let's go with the acronyms. And the truth is, for example, for Boston, which I was really surprised to hear, it's all about racism, racial equity. We're talking about a city that has, you know, over 200 languages spoken there. 50% of the population is black, and a lot of people do not know that. So how do you manage to make sure that all parts of the society and community feel that they are on an equal footing? And that's something that, you know, the chief resilience officer for Boston, Atia Martin, told me on the first day of the summit.
We are very fortunate in Boston that we have so much work happening, but there's so much more to do. And even in the face of the current political environment at the national level with the current president, we do have a whole set of tools that we can leverage at the local level, and it means that we have to be very creative in terms of resources, considering that many of the sources of funding that we're helping with a lot of those types of programs came from the federal level. So we're really excited about the possibilities of what it means to be even more explicit about how we help other city agencies and other organizations and people in the city to really understand the contributions of our immigrant community to the city, as well as what it means to the social diversity and benefits of the city.
So, Carlotta, now that the summit is over, what is the next step for this network of resilience officers that it's created?
No, so they announced on the last day of the summit that they're creating a leaders network, where in this case they're bringing city mayors of some of the cities that are part of this network into the fold. Now, that is a big step, because obviously the representation is quite different, and the way that the position of the mayor is established already, and it's going to be able to allow from some different leverage. But the truth is that, you know, this network is really a sign of defiance in a way, because as we just heard, the current administration here in the United States has been, you know, the hot topic when you talk with urban leaders about the way it affects their cities. And the message has really been, you know, this just has forced cities to act just a bit quicker in terms of what they would like to achieve because of how unstable the prospects of funding or of what happens next to in federal and state policy can be. And the plan to go ahead, you know, includes everything from, you know, trying to have more inclusive design. How do you do that? By connecting to the private sector. Or in like one of the things I like to say that is as abstract as it sounds, but I'll explain more, which is big bets in transformative ideas. And one of the examples they gave was from Paris, where they're using the schools as community anchors. So it's like one of the densest cities in Europe with very little green spaces. So they're reimagining the school courtyards, making sure that they become an anchor for the community, because they want to transform by 2040 nearly 700 school courtyards. And that's half a billion square meters. That's a huge number. Or in New York, that they want to achieve zero waste by 2030. Or you know, in Mandalay, that just, you know, in the next 20 years, they're committed to zero emissions. So the fact that these networks have, these cities, part of the network, have set these goals for them, regardless of whether their own country is following the same policy, is something to look forward to. And I know we're going to be following the progress of these 100 cities in on Monocle 24. And I think there's really good things to come out of this.
Monocle's Carlotta Arabello joining us from New York. Thank you very much. We'll have a New York-themed end for you in just a moment. That does bring us pretty much to the end of this Monocle Daily, which was produced by Tom Hall. Our researchers are Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hester Underhill, and our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Don't forget the weekend edition. It kicks off at 8 a.m. London time tomorrow and also on Sunday, while the Monocle Daily returns at 2200 London time on Monday. Sooner than that, we'll be off to the Canadian Food Championships in 2 hours' time, and a chance to catch up with the most recent edition of The Menu. And before Guy Lutz takes over with some music on the Pacific Shift, I will leave you with a less celebrated classic from the New York song canon. This is Ace Frehley of Kiss and New York Groove. From me, Paul Osborne, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye, and have a great weekend.
Many years since I was here. On the street, I was passing my time away. Into the sky, it's out of sight.